This is the Friday Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. Welcome to WLRN. It was 6 years ago this week, one of the holiest records in baseball was broken.
Deals. And Bonds hits one high. Hits it deep. It is out of here. 7.56. Bonds stands alone. He is on top of the all-time home run list.
Barry Bonds with the San Francisco Giants hitting home run 756 6 years ago this week, breaking Hank Aaron's career home run record. Now, 6 years later, here we are. Bonds has been discredited, convicted of obstruction of justice over an investigation into the use of performance-enhancing drugs. Now, that home run 6 years ago may have signaled the end of Major League Baseball's silence on players using performance-enhancing drugs. This week, one of South Florida's own and highest-paid player in the league, Alice Rodriguez, was suspended for more than an entire season for using drugs, a charge he is appealing, but not exactly denying either.
Obviously disappointed with the news today, no question about it. But what we've always fought for is for the process, and I think we have that. And at some point, we'll sit in front of an arbiter and give our case. And that's as much as I feel comfortable telling you right now.
Do you deny that you use PEDs?
Like I said, I think we'll have a forum to discuss all of that. And we'll talk about it then.
Julie Brown, the investigative reporter with the Miami Herald, with us here on the Florida Roundup. Tim Ilfrank, managing editor at Miami New Times. Tim, you broke the story on Biogenesis, the Coral Gables lab or facility that's at the heart of this investigation with Major League Baseball and Alice Rodriguez. How did we get to this point this week where we saw Major League Baseball finally, 6 years after Barry Bonds broke the home run record, which was obvious to everybody there was performance-enhancing drugs involved with his career later in the years, to the point where we're at today, Alex Rodriguez suspended for more than a season?
Yeah, I think it is a really interesting contrast between the response to Biogenesis and to Balco, almost a decade ago.
That was the San Francisco lab involved with Barry Bonds.
That's right. And, when that scandal broke, Major League Baseball and the Players Union were notably silent and really had a laissez-faire approach to the entire thing, which, of course, eventually led to congressional hearings, to the Mitchell Report. Commissioner Bud Selig was really savaged in front of Congress for letting this problem get to this point. And this time around, we saw a completely different response from baseball. We published our story in January about the clinic Biogenesis and its owner, Tony Bosch, the records that showed he was selling performance-enhancing drugs to a number of athletes. And within a matter of weeks, baseball had an investigative team down here in South Florida pursuing the case really aggressively, and some have said too aggressively with some of their tactics. But there's no question that they, in the years between Biogenesis and Balco, they built up a totally different infrastructure to address these kind of problems.
Julie, how did this Coral Gables lab get to the center of this current investigation into performance-enhancing drugs in Major League Baseball?
Well, they had an investor, an employee who was, quite frankly, disgruntled, who worked there, and he came forward. He obtained a lot of records that contained names of people, clients, and obviously some names of some Major League Baseball players. And he came forward and made those public. Went to the Miami New Times, and subsequently, they published this story, and it was something that Major League Baseball couldn't ignore. It was out there, and it was picked up all over the nation, all over the world.
And so what happened this week for not only sports fans, but South Floridians, that one of their own was caught up this in a very big way? Tell us what the accusations are against Rodriguez.
Well, he has always maintained that the only time that he has taken performance-enhancing drugs was when he was playing for the Texas Rangers, which was in 2001 to 2003. And he wasn't disciplined for it at that time. And since then, he has maintained he hasn't done any of those he hasn't taken any PEDs. But it turns out that subsequently he has the records show that he has been using the PEDs since then.
Yeah, these were records, Tim, that came from Biogenesis that you were able to uncover.
Yeah, that's right. We, you know, we included Alex in our initial report in January. You know, it's pretty clear from the records that, you know, he was a client of Tony Bosch. You know, they do seem to indicate that he was buying HGH, testosterone, and other banned substances. And I would just add, too, you know, the punishment that came down on this past Monday, 12 players were suspended for 50 games each, and right. they all accepted that punishment without right. fighting it. Alex Rodriguez, by contrast, was banned for 211 games. And the difference there was, number one, that baseball felt that he had repeatedly lied about his use of these drugs, but they also alleged that he interfered in their investigation, that he tried to prevent them from coming to this conclusion.
Rodriguez was asked at his first news conference when he made his debut with the Yankees this year. He's been rehabbing an injury in Chicago against the White Sox, and he was asked if he thought he was being singled out.
Alex, do you feel that this is a witch hunt by Major League Baseball?
I don't want to discuss that. I don't know what the motivation is for any of this, but I'm going to respect the process. I feel good that we have an opportunity to do that in the right platform.
All right, so the non-denial there. Julie, let's talk about a couple of the other characters. I mean, A-Rod is the headline in this storyline. A couple of the other names, one we've mentioned already, Tony Bosch. Who's he? What role did he play with Biogenesis and this investigation?
Well, he owned a company. First, he started out in Boca with another anti-aging clinic. He broke off from that, and he formed another similar company down here in South Florida called BioChem. His father is a physician. His name and his father's name came up in a scandal in 2009 surrounding another PED scandal surrounding Manny Ramirez. Mm-hmm. They were never charged in connection with that, but the feds had their eye on them for a while. And fast forward to 2013, again, their name came out in the scandal that the New Times wrote about. And once again, you know, this time it was even worse because they couldn't hide it. And whereas and feds and prosecutors and Major League Baseball obviously couldn't ignore it this time. And this time it came out that he wasn't a doctor. He was professing himself to be some quasi-doctor. The clients at the clinic called him Dr. Bosch. Mm. He was writing prescriptions when he didn't have a license. So he was breaking quite a number of laws, you know, writing prescriptions without a license, prescribing PEDs for non-medicinal purposes.
Had this garnered any attention on the part of state or federal regulators prior to this story and the involvement with Major League Baseball?
Well, 2009, they did investigate it, but it seems that they kind of dropped off their radar. And then when it came out in 2013, earlier this year in January, the DEA said that they were looking at it, but they were looking at it from the standpoint of the suppliers to the clinics, not necessarily the Bosches themselves.
Interesting. So looking at the wholesalers, kind of not the retailers. We're talking about the A-Rod scandal and the involvement with the Coral Gables laboratory here in South Florida. Julie Brown is an investigative reporter with the Miami Herald. Tim Ilfrink with the Miami New Times. And join the conversation online on Twitter at WLRN. You can join us on the website at WLRN.org and call in at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN, and I'm Tom Hudson. Tim, the other person involved in this storyline is a guy by the name of Porter Fisher. He was your primary source for the story back in January that really began this this entire scandal. Tell us about Porter.
That's right. Porter was a longtime client of Tony Bosch's clinic who became an investor, invested $4,000, and was given the title of marketing manager and access to the clinic. And ended up quarreling with the owner, Tony Bosch, who wasn't repaying his investment as he had promised, and ended up sharing the records he had with the clinic with us, with the primary purpose of showing what Tony Bosch was up to. You know, Porter, his interest wasn't necessarily in going after these baseball players. You know, he felt that Tony was breaking the law, was, you know, doing this in a very obvious way in broad daylight in Coral Gables.
He felt wrong because he was owed money.
That's right.
By Tony Bosch in the clinic. And number two, he had been a client of the clinic, and he was led to believe, Julie, to the point you made earlier, that Bosch was an MD, had all of the regulatory necessities and licenses to be able to prescribe these kinds of elements that he was using on his patients.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. He like a number of other clients, did believe, you know, everyone called him Dr. Tony or Dr. Bosch. You know, he had a license hanging on his wall that he'd gotten at a medical school down in Belize. And, he felt, you know, by putting this out there that it would spark a criminal probe into Tony Bosch and expose what he was doing. And it's kind of funny in a way because that's the one piece of the story that really hasn't happened just yet.
That's right. There isn't that criminal probe. Major League Baseball still is looking into it. Where is the status of their investigation? And because Bosch now has agreed to cooperate with MLB.
That's right. That's the reason they were able to suspend all these players. They filed a civil case against Bosch and a number of his associates at the clinic, claiming that they had damaged the sport. And, you know, it was a legal argument that a lot of people ridiculed. It was very questionable, remains questionable how it'll hold up in court. But, it got them what they wanted. It put pressure on Tony Bosch, who, you know, was already in financial difficulty, to cooperate. And so in June, he agreed to cooperate with them in exchange for them dropping the civil case against him and giving him personal security. So that's how they were able to build this case against all these players.
So that's on the civil side. That's a corporation, Major League Baseball, against an individual here, Tony Bosch. Julie, what about the government? What about regulators? To the point made earlier by Tim, there has been no criminal charges filed as of yet. Do we know if there's any criminal investigation undergoing?
Well, they say that there is one going, but there's a lot of question about how serious it is. The Department of Health has regulatory oversight over these kinds of clinics and also over doctors who operate without a license, like the Botox things that have been happening.
Right.
And the investigator who actually put a lot of time and energy into interviewing clients of the clinic and to taking depositions and to really getting to the bottom of this whole clinic and how it operated was told to basically stand down and not do anything about it. And a lot of questions have been raised about why he was told to back off. Now, it could have been because DEA was already on top of it and working on it. Some people think that that could be the answer, or it could be that, the Bosches seem to have been sort of, hands off for a while. A lot of people have been letting them, go for a while.
Yeah, so Bosch is cooperating with Major League Baseball in its investigation. A-Rod has been suspended for a season and a half, but is appealing that. In the meantime, Porter Fisher, the source of how this story came to light, Tim, is where?
Well, he's still facing his own case in civil court. You know, Major League Baseball has asked him to turn over every record he's got in the case.
And are these the same records he gave to you?
Possibly more than that. You know, I mean, he has a number of records from this clinic, and they want everything they can get their hands on. And, his position has been pretty consistent in this, that he agreed to help Department of Health when they came and asked him to help because he wanted to see a criminal case built against Tony Bosch. Whereas he doesn't see Major League Baseball as being a place that's going to go after Tony for what Tony's role in this thing was. So that's why he's been resisting this from day one.
Tim Elfrink with the Miami New Times. Julie Brown, investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. I'm Tom Hudson here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Still lots more to come. This Coral Gables clinic now has the attention of state high school athletic officials. Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson here on WLRN talking about the scandal in Major League Baseball over performance-enhancing drugs that traces its roots to a Coral Gables clinic. Tim Elfrink with the Miami New Times, Julie Brown of the Miami Herald have covered this topic quite a bit. And of course, we want your input on Twitter at WLRN. You can email us as well. That is thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. Online, WLRN.org. And of course, old school. Pick up the phone. Give us a ring. 800-743-9576. 800-743-9576. WLRN. Do you have any connection to this clinic? Have you known any athlete that has taken performance-enhancing drugs? And Julie, this week it came about that Florida high school athletic officials now are beginning to look into the connection that this clinic may have had potentially to high school athletes here in South Florida. Tell us where that stands with high school athletic regulators.
Well, they have they obviously have been paying attention to this since it came out that at least a dozen players from high school teams, mostly private schools, though, however, are on the list in these records as having taken some kind of what they call performance sports concoctions. There's a steroid kind of package that some of these kids, some of them as young as 16.
Some of them can be creams, but are we talking about injections as well?
Yeah, injections as well. And these were kids that came in, sometimes with their parents, to the clinic and received these kinds of concoctions. They cost sometimes as much as $300 to $500 a month to get these packages. And so the Florida Athletic Association is now sitting up and paying attention and thinking that they should look at these rules and reevaluate how these kinds of clinics are taking advantage of young people. The problem is they don't really have a whole lot of regulatory authority.
Well, I was just going to ask, I mean, are performance-enhancing drugs against the rules in high school athletics in Florida?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, and not in Florida. But they are against the law if you're prescribing them for reasons other than health conditions.
Right.
You know, you can prescribe them legally if you have some kind of medical condition. But number one, the sports performance enhancing packages obviously aren't because of a medical condition. And number two, he wasn't licensed to prescribe anything.
Yeah. Tim, in your search through the records, what did you find in regards to the involvement with this clinic in Coral Gables with potential high school athletes?
Well, as Julie said, I mean, Porter has said repeatedly that he's believes that there are high school athletes linked to this clinic.
And Porter is the source of the records that you published in January.
That's right. And I think it's interesting to note, too, that, this isn't a new situation with the youth sports culture in Florida. You know, there have been stories about the role this has played, particularly in the highly competitive baseball scene down here for decades. If you read the Selena Roberts book about Alex Rodriguez from a few years ago, you know, a number of his teammates from Westminster believe that he started using performance-enhancing drugs as early as his, sophomore year at Westminster High School. And, you know, there isn't any hard evidence of that, but you know, those kind of scandals and that kind of pressure to perform has been for decades in South Florida sports scene.
Absolutely. And that kind of pressure isn't necessarily going to go away because of this scandal and because of a professional sports league like Major League Baseball, which for so long was silent about performance-enhancing drugs, finally has kind of brought the hammer down on stars like Alex Rodriguez. But it gets to the broader point here, and you've heard this from some other Major League Baseball players, that, okay, finally Major League Baseball is taking it serious, weeding out folks that are juicing and showing that to the young students that it doesn't pay. That's always the message that we seem to have at least once a decade, be it in the 1980s with professional football in the NFL and possibly now here in the 21st century with Major League Baseball.
Yeah, and I think it is a fair point to make. I mean, it certainly sends a message all the way through the system to see players of this high profile, Nelson Cruz or Ryan Braun, taking suspensions for violating these policies. If baseball's serious about it, they still have a lot of work to do on it. I mean, I think, you know, another emerging story in this is the fact that the vast majority of these players came out of Latin countries with, you know, youth development systems where there's, maybe to another exponential factor than the Miami youth system to perform to really excel, and with a lot less regulations and safeguards to prevent people from using these kind of drugs.
Do we know anything about international distribution on the part of this Biogenesis?
In terms of its links to Biogenesis, I think that's an emerging story, but there's no question that, you know, pharmacies in the Dominican Republic and Venezuela and Cuba, you know, these drugs can be bought over the counter. There's really very little regulation on how to get your hands on these things.
By an emerging story, you mean one that has yet to be published in Miami New Times?
We shall see.
There's also, from what I understand, there's also pharmacies here in, I heard that there's one in Little Havana where they obtain some of these drugs. drugs. And as for the kids in Latin America, it's not only the fact that they see this as a, you know, that it's so available there, but you have to remember the people that they look up to, the mentors, even their parents, older people, to them, they want them to succeed. It's a way out of poverty for a lot of them. And so there isn't anybody standing up there saying you shouldn't be doing this. I mean, yeah, maybe Major League Baseball is up here saying that, and maybe they can see the news reports. But when the people that are right around you saying, right, here you go, this is going to make you rich, this is going to make you successful, it's very hard to fight against that.
Yeah, that's Julie Brown with the Miami Herald. That's on the household level, kind of. That's the parental level or the guardian level. But let's take it back out to the regulatory level. And I think fair questions are still being asked. Where are the criminal charges here? If Major League Baseball is a private corporation which has the ability and the okay on the part of the federal government to operate as a monopoly, as it does within its business of baseball, it seems to have gotten the ability to move before criminal investigators and government investigators looking into this, be it either prescribing medicine for non-medical reasons or distribution of controlled substances, whatever those investigations may be. The private investigation seems to be much further along the line.
Well, remember, one of the other things on this list is that there's quite a number of police officers that patronize this clinic. There's some lawyers. There's at least one judge's name apparently on this list. So when you have together a whole community of law enforcement people that are on this list, they probably don't want their names. Police officers aren't supposed to be using steroids to bulk up.
Yep.
So, you know, there's a question of whether that could have in some ways have impeded law enforcement or prosecutors from getting involved in this, you know, aggressively anyway.
And Tim, I think those two last points there, the parental involvement, and there's nobody at the household level necessarily telling these kids that, listen, this is not the way to improve and not the way to make it big. And the second questions are, where were the regulators and where are the regulators even today, are questions that need to be answered and need to be asked, and why this story is so important for folks that don't know who A-Rod is, don't know, you know, anything all about Major League Baseball.
Yeah, no question about it. And I think it is a problem if you have the number of people that apparently are out there in South Florida selling drugs that have never been tested or regulated to people who don't know what they're putting in their bodies, and especially if they're minors. That should be a serious question for any parent in South Florida.
Tim Elfrink with the Miami New Times, Julie Brown with the Miami Herald here along with us. I'm Tom Hudson. It is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Some other news this week, a tragic news in Miami Beach. A police officer there is on paid leave now after using his taser stun gun on an 18-year-old graffiti artist early Tuesday morning. The teenager, Israel Hernandez, died after being tasered in the chest. Now, his last graffiti mural is on a closed McDonald's restaurant at 71st and Collins, and that's where mourners gathered. The Herald captured this.
Where? Show me! You! Show me what he did to deserve to die! He was an artist! This building has not been operating for a long time. How dare you kill somebody for their artistic expression?
Real tragic story here this week with still lots of questions unanswered. Tim, what do we know right now here 4 days after this awful incident?
What we know right now is that an 18-year-old named Israel Hernandez was apparently caught tagging an abandoned McDonald's.
Spray painting
an abandoned McDonald's building that's, you know, if you see photos, is already pretty thoroughly covered with graffiti and posters. And ran away from some police officers that confronted him about it. Apparently quite a large number of officers ended up chasing him for a number of minutes. And the end result was that he was tasered in the chest and ended up dying a few minutes later. And obviously raises some pretty serious questions. You know, was it appropriate to use a taser on an 18-year-old who, you know, by all accounts was not violent, was, you know, very slight of stature with that many police officers involved? Number two, was it appropriate to even initiate a chase over such a minor offense like this?
Now, the Miami PD has said that it's confident the officers acted appropriately and within the guidelines. What do we know about the response, the official response so far?
Well, I think that their initial and it's careful to say that their initial investigation is saying that that it appears that it was appropriate to use the taser at that point. Whether it'll eventually come out that that was appropriate, the investigation will find out. But the question is, these taser guns. This has happened before. People have been police have killed people with tasers before, and these tasers have to be used appropriately. That's the key to them. And if you don't know how to use them properly, people can die from them.
Do we know anything about training for these taser guns on the part of the PD?
Well, we don't. I mean, we probably that's probably the next questions that are going to be asked on how they have been used. The other issue is Miami Beach Police have had a history and a track record of using excessive force. There have been many problems, lawsuits against them, criminal charges brought against some of them. So that doesn't help their situation.
Also questions about the transparency of Miami Beach Police when it comes to these kind of tragic incidences. And Julie, you've written a lot about this. Tim, you as well in your publication. The question about the fatal shooting Memorial Day weekend back in Urban Beach Week in 2011 when a Miami Beach PD officer shot and killed a man. And those questions are still being asked. So not that these two are related in the specifics incidents, but to Julie's point, Tim, talk to us about the transparency that the department has had historically and what it's having over this case.
It's really been, from my perspective as a journalist, it's really been atrocious. I mean, you know, even before the Memorial Day shooting, you know, there was another case with an officer named Adam Tavs who was later kicked off the force and after that was arrested for running a grow house out of his house. And he shot and killed an unarmed tourist from Washington in a confrontation on Washington Avenue. And for years, no one could get any records related to this. Family, lawyers, attorneys, journalists. And it's just routine. It becomes routine to say, well, it's an open investigation, so we can't release any of this. And I mean, there's got to be a point where someone puts in a reasonable guideline on how long an investigation can remain open so that there can be some accountability for these kind of cases.
Julie, would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's taken years and years and years for some of these cases for information to come out and lawsuits upon lawsuits for these victims. And they really never get closure on some of these cases. And and the public should demand to know what exactly happened and to have some kind of accountability on the part of its police force.
Accountability and responsibility, very important. All right, we've got Julie Brown with the Miami Herald, Tim Elfrink with Miami New Times here on the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. Still lots more to come, including your input on Twitter at WLRN and on the phone line at 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576. Talking politics in the Sunshine State coming up next. Federal agents don't knock on the mayor's door. Two local mayors find themselves in the crosshairs of the Department of Justice accused of taking kickbacks. So is this just an all too familiar story for local politics? That's next. Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Two mayors, even friends, who planned a unique way to raise some money for charity this fall, hand-to-hand fighting, instead find themselves fighting for their freedom. Sweetwater Mayor Manny Moronio and Michael Pizzi, Mayor of Miami Lakes, have canceled their September fight, an MMA fight, after both were arrested this week by federal agents accused of taking kickbacks from lobbyists.
We are alleging that Manuel Moronio, the mayor of Sweetwater, since 2002, is alleged to have received more than $40,000 in bribes. And similarly, Michael Pizzi, the mayor of Miami Lakes, is alleged to have received $6,750 in bribes.
That's the U.S. prosecutor announcing the charges this week in the case of two mayors. We've got a couple of experts, journalists that have been following the case very closely. Jay Weaver, federal courts reporter at the Miami Herald, joining us by phone. Francisco Alvarado with the Miami New Times along with us. Francisco, follow the money for this case for us here.
Okay.
Tell us where the money came from and what the two mayors are accused of doing with it.
Well, the money came from the federal government. Actually, what happened is the feds set up a fake corporation and then claimed that they were, getting these grants through AmeriCorps. And basically, I mean, you know, they had the money you know, for the investigation, and they hooked up with the first lobbyist, Richard Candia,
mm-hmm.
and you know, explained to him the scheme of how they could, you know, get these grants, you know, for the municipalities, and once they got these grants, that they would be able to, like, you know, divvy up the money amongst themselves, and everybody would make a, you know, would make a buck, and no one's the wiser.
Jay, who's accused of initiating this scheme? Is it the mayors or the lobbyists?
Well, I would say that it started with a confidential source who happens to be a Miami-Dade lobbyist. And he approached the FBI and told them that he knew that there were corruptible mayors in Miami-Dade County, and he knew just the lobbyists who could get to them to sell them this sting operation. And that lobbyist was Richard Candia, and the mayors were Mayor Michael Pizzi of Miami Lakes and Manny Moronio of Sweetwater. So the confidential source knew who to approach. He'd worked with Candia, and then the undercover agents posing as the Chicago-based businessman with a company called Sunshine Universal made the pitch, making it very clear up front that it was going to be totally bogus, and it was meant entirely to enrich the lobbyists and the mayors and not their towns, and that it was all just an HBO special brought to you by the FBI, but they never disclosed that. It was all purported. But the intent of the lobbyists and the mayors come across in recorded conversations that they were on board and they wanted the money to line their own pockets.
Jay, you used an interesting phrase, corruptible public officials. Not corrupt, but the ability to be corrupted. Francisco, is that a fishing expedition, essentially, that the prosecutors may have gone on here, or the FBI?
Well, no, I mean, they had probable cause, and the predicate was the confidential source had reason to believe that the mayors were corruptible, as were their lobbyists, as well as Richard Candia. And so that was sort of the basis for obtaining the wiretap and all the recording devices. And, of course, the agents were wearing devices themselves, mm-hmm. and they had recording devices on the phones of Manny Moronio, the Sweetwater mayor, as well as Jorge Forte, the lobbyist, who was his front man, according to the allegations in the criminal complaint.
The two mayors, Francisco, made their initial court appearances this week. What's the next step for them?
Well, basically, I think the next step is for them is just to find out how much the government knows. I think the next step is, you know, the discovery process where they, you know, their lawyers will ask, you know, the government to release whatever, you know, evidence they got against their clients. What's interesting to note in the indictments themselves, it's noted that, you know, not every single recorded conversation or every piece of evidence is listed in the complaint. So I think that, you know, right now they're probably just batting down their hatches and, you know, just kind of like trying to figure out what the government knows and how they're best going to be able to fight and, you know, and build their case.
Well, let's talk about what we know about these mayors here. What do we know about the Miami Lakes mayor, Michael Pizzi, town attorney for Medley, UM law grad, and again, this MMA match that these two mayors just happen to have on their calendar for September?
Well, Mike Pizzi's somebody that I know very well, kind of, and which is kind of like, you know, ironic. I was very surprised.
Did you know him well? Were you surprised
by
this?
Yeah, because I mean, one of my first stories at Miami New Times.
Would you ever describe him as corruptible?
No. Self-righteous. A little more like, you know, a little media hungry. And this was like, I mean, again, I mean, like I wrote a profile of him when I first started at New Times 10 years ago. And back then, I mean, he was like a crusader. I mean, he was fighting against the developers. He would take on pro bono cases. In one case, I was just reading the article last night. In one case, he took on pro bono was this woman who was being a homeowner in the Redland who was the victim of a slap suit, which is when somebody sues you to sue you because they can, and to in an effort to like make her be quiet about what she was talking about, and she was basically just being vocal against this landfill out in the homestead that was you know making people sick,
mm-hmm.
and the owner of the landfill filed this lawsuit against her, and then Pizzi took on this case pro bono, and that's what he was known for, taking on these cases and, you know, being the guy that was, you know, fighting against all these developers. At the same time, though, at that time, people thought that he was doing it, you know, for media attention and that he was, you know, self-righteous. But no one ever described him as corruptible back then.
Well, it certainly is now. Jay, what about Mayor Moronio from Sweetwater? Certainly a confidant, if not close confidant, but at least a confidant of Governor Scott, and rumored to have aspirations for higher office.
Well, for one thing, from a criminal perspective, the evidence in the case against Moronio is much stronger than the case against Michael Pizzi. Moronio and his so-called frontman, Jorge Forte, are all over the tapes. They took collectively $60,000 in cash. They make a lot of incriminating statements about their desire, you know, for this money, this grant money. And they know that the scheme, or at least it's conveyed that they know the scheme is bogus and that they're just in it to make money. And, you know, as far as Moronio goes, it's a shocker because he is close to the governor. He was one of the few, if not the only, Republican Latin, you know, leader, you know, in Miami-Dade who supported Scott instead of McCollum in the primary for Republican nominee for governor. And, you know, he's been a major force in Sweetwater and in Latin politics for years. And he also set up a consulting business with Jorge Forte, lobbying business that he made no bones about was intended to capitalize on his relationship with the governor. He said in interviews in early 2011 that, you know, this is going to be local, state, you know, and we're going to go great guns and, you know, we're going to build, it's called Seven Strategies, and we're going to try to, like, build on, you know, Governor Scott's jobs program, and we're going to try to tap into local and state, you know, lobbying contracts. And he made it very clear that he was going to capitalize on his connections to the governor.
Seven Strategies, the name of his consulting group, of course, a play on Governor Scott's seven-year job plan that he ran for election so successfully with. Jay Weaver of the Miami Herald, you mentioned the amount of money involved here. How much is each mayor accused of profiting?
Well, $60,000 that Mayor Moronio and Jorge Forte, the lobbyists, split, you know, and in the case of Michael Pizzi, he received $6,000 cash, $750 in campaign contributions, so a much smaller amount. And Richard Candia received $5,000 for the Sweetwater deal, nothing for Pizzi's Miami Lakes and Medley deals. And for making the arrangements to meet these people, Candia was also paid, to meet these mayors, he was also paid $500.
Francisco, it always surprises people sometimes when public officials are accused of corruption and taking kickbacks about the relatively small amount of money that's involved here. Not that the tens of thousands of dollars involved here are chump change. They're not. But in terms of betraying the public trust and betraying their office, this is not a lot of money.
Right. But, I mean, you know, you can probably think that, that since it's not a lot of money, nobody's going to notice. I mean,
that's flies under radar then,
you know,
right?
They think they're flying under the radar. They're like, you know, they're in these small towns and that don't get much attention. But think about it. I mean, if this is true and the confidential source, you know, had told the FBI that these are guys that, you know, that you could go to and they could, you know, be corrupted, makes you wonder, I mean, like if they were getting other kinds of payoffs, because, you know, then it's not a little amount, it probably adds up to a lot.
Francisco Alvarado of Miami New Times, Jay Weaver, federal courts reporter at the Miami Herald. Jay, is this an all-too-familiar story in South Florida politics?
Well, it's significant that you bust two mayors and two lobbyists on one day. That's what sets this story apart. But as you know, for years and decades, there have been corruption story after corruption story. I mean, you know, they, you know, call, you know, you know, Miami, they don't call Miami Casablanca for nothing. It's not some sort of a, you know, hyperbolic metaphor. It's the real deal. There's always corruption going on, and there are very corruptible politicians in town, and it's been going back years and decades. And the feds are turning up the volume. The state attorney's office could turn it up a little more. But, you know, this is a significant case, and it will make a splash, and it will probably cause a chill in the community, at least for a few months. You know, I'm sure the greedy hands of a lot of politicians will be sticking out, you know, soon enough when this blows over. But for now, I think there's going to be a chill out there.
Francisco, you've covered some of these smaller municipalities and these leaders. Do you agree with Jay's assessment that some of those other potentially corruptible leaders may keep their head down?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a period of, like, you know, cooling off, you know, when people get arrested and get busted. And I'm just wondering, like, you know, if the FBI, I mean, what else they have got going on, and if we're going to see more arrests coming down the pike. But I also think that there's more sophisticated schemes going on that can continue going on without, you know, until somebody's, you know, goes to the FBI and says, hey, look, you guys need to look here and start an investigation.
Always helps to have a mole, certainly. Jay, would tighter ethics laws for our elected leaders have helped in this case?
No. I mean, what you have to recognize is that there have been ethics laws and ethics commissions and ethics seminars and all kinds of things taught to county, city employees, to all these politicians and lobbyists. It all kind of falls on mostly deaf ears. I mean, the vast majority of people do behave themselves, but you're always going to have rotten apples. What you really need here is, you know, more people from the outside dropping down, more insiders coming forward. And, you know, what you have here is a problem with cooperation in public corruption cases. The lobbyists and the politicians aren't going to come forward.
Do we need stronger whistleblower laws to protect those whistleblowers in Florida?
Well, the FBI and, you know, and other agencies do a good job of protecting their sources. That's not the issue. The issue is just cultivating these sources. They don't grow on trees. And these lobbyists and these politicians are just not going to be ratting each other out. It's a very rare thing. So it's very hard to find, you know, these patriots, these good Samaritans out there to come forward with inside information while crimes are being committed. That's why you have sting operations, because you're basically creating a crime for people who are predisposed to committing them. And it's not entrapment. And you just, again, create an HBO special to see if they're predisposed. In this case, the evidence is pretty strong that, you know, these two mayors were both predisposed, especially Mayor Moreno. The case against Pizzi, again, is not quite as strong.
Sure. So we've got a quick question from our Twitter feed, at WLRN, asking the question, is this potentially a case of these mayors having full-time jobs leading these municipalities but getting part-time pay?
Well, you know, in the case of Mike Pizzi, I mean, he was making a six-figure salary as the town attorney for the town of Medley.
Right.
I mean, so, I mean, I don't think you can make that argument that, you know, the mayors that don't, you know, don't get paid a lot of money, they capitalize on the fact that they're mayors of a small town to be able to get, you know, these other cushy jobs in other places.
Francisco Alvarado, the Miami New Times with us, and Jay Weaver, the federal courts reporter at the Miami Herald. Thank you, guys. We've got plenty more stories here to talk about, including in South Florida this week, witnessing the return of professional world-class football. Yeah, did you miss this? The Dolphins may have lost their first preseason game, but football was back. Of course, this was international soccer. The International Champions Cup played 2 days of matches, wrapping up the tournament, pitching some of the best international clubs against each other. Kenny Malone from WLRN was in Sun Life Stadium for 2 nights, 4 matches, I believe it was.
I was there for 1 night, but really, you know.
And the return of international soccer to Florida, a success?
A booming success. And the stakes were arguably higher than ever. About 2 months ago to the day, Sun Life Stadium hosted a match between Haiti's national team and Spain's national team. Now, obviously, there's a built-in contingency for Haiti's Haitian support. Spain is arguably the best team ever in any sport.
In the world, right?
So the argument was, let's bring this here. People will come. There were about 34,000 empty seats for that event. And that was a problem that had a lot of people worried, in part because the argument about South Florida soccer has always been that South Florida's soccer fan is, and you'll hear this all the time, is a savvy soccer fan. They watch international soccer. They know high-quality soccer. And that is arguably why American soccer has not succeeded here in the past.
Presumably, that's what we got this week.
And I mean, that was the real test, right?
The championship game pitted two of the best private soccer clubs in the world.
Right, and two of the most popular soccer clubs in the world. And so that's why we were watching this really closely. This was sort of a test of this hypothesis that if you bring it here, will they come?
And so...
Well, you know, on the first night, attendance was about 38,000 people.
So which looks like an empty stadium.
The wave doesn't work. It's like a ripples in a puddle.
That's
right. None of the cheers work. People came out for the finals. There were about 67,000 people. Sun Life Stadium holds about 70,000. I believe that's the second largest crowd that Sun Life has hosted for an international soccer match. The biggest was for a Barcelona match a few years back. So big turnout, and the stakes were really high.
This was certainly very far from a Super Bowl kind of atmosphere, but what was the general atmosphere within the parking lot of Sun Life and within the stadium? I mean, did you get any sense of demand for a follow-up kind of performance after this kind of international soccer?
I think the demand is absolutely there. People came out with in full accoutrement, and they knew chants for the clubs, and it was very clear. When people say Miami is an international city with soccer savvy taste, this is what they meant. Now, the $1 million question, or in some cases, $85 million question, is does this support now show that Miami is ready for a Major League Soccer club?
Right.
And that's the question that's in the air. David Beckham has reportedly been sniffing around, touring Sun Life Stadium, going to FIU Stadium, which holds about 20 to 25,000 people, a lot more in the ballpark of what we're talking about for a stadium for MLS. He can buy a franchise for an absolute steal, $25 million. To give you some perspective, Orlando is making a very serious bid at an MLS expansion team. They are estimated at about $70 million for the franchise fees. So Beckham would be crazy not to buy a team. The question is, will it be Miami? And the attendance for these international soccer matches is certainly something that the MLS is considering in choosing where it will place its four expansion teams.
And I'm sure a question that David Beckham and his supporters and supporters of bringing Major League Baseball to South Florida continuously ask is, what happened to the Miami Fusion?
The Miami Fusion,
tell
yes.
us the quick story of the Miami Fusion and why that's always seen as perhaps reasons why professional soccer may not work in South Florida.
The Miami Fusion died in January of 2002. It had been in the league for just 4 years. One of the statistics is always quoted about that the Fusion was on the rise was that attendance to Fusion matches increased 49% into their final season. That giant bump put them ninth overall in attendance. That's in a league of 12 at the time. Ultimately, the owner of the team said sort of infamously and famously that, quote, South Florida is a very difficult market, which has always been the paradox when it comes to soccer, right? Like, presumably there are loads of soccer fans,
right,
people who grew up playing soccer, and yet this franchise couldn't survive. That's in part because the MLS may have expanded too quickly, but in part because it wasn't a successful franchise. Some people say that was largely because the home stadium was Lockhart Stadium, which is in Fort Lauderdale.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the Miami Fusion playing in Fort Lauderdale. You have that brand problem. But there is a big question about whether or not South Florida's fan is soccer savvy too much, which is sort of a nice way of saying, are we soccer snobs down here?
Right. Well, it's certainly not the case earlier this week with the International Champions Cup there at Sun Life Stadium, and a great match, certainly, with Chelsea and Real Madrid. Kenny Malone from WLRN was there and joining us here today. Now, coming up Monday on the Sunshine Economy, we're talking energy. More and more of our electricity we rely on to cool our homes and light our businesses comes from natural gas here in Florida. We're second in the nation in burning the gas to make electricity. We'll be talking about that with executives from FPL. And also, going on a drive with Linda Gassenheimer and her all-electric car. That all comes up Monday morning, 9 a.m. here on WLRN and the Sunshine Economy. That's it for the Florida Roundup on this week here on WLRN. We will have the program back on the air 6 a.m. tomorrow morning, also on the website at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman, our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow, our executive producer for WLRN, Peter J. Mertz, our technical supervisor, Paul Leary, making sure we run on time. And be sure to stay tuned here on WLRN. We've got South Florida Arts Beat coming up next on the airwaves. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.